So, like I said, I come back up through the night. You're not done with me yet. But now I'd like to welcome Grant Watson, Anique Fournier, and their cast of readers to the stage. Not quite done yet. I won't say too much, though, I promise, as Grant and Anique have very carefully crafted their own overview interview to introduce the work they do together, or I should say, the work we do together. How We Behave, an Archive of Radical Practice, is a project in critical praxis quite dear to my heart, which I've been developing with Grant and Anique since the fall of 2020, when, if I can't dance, I Don't Want to Be Part of Your Revolution, the organization where Anique and I work, launched its digital platform, ificantdance.studio, with Grant's How We Behave as one of our first projects. So I just say quickly, for those of you who aren't familiar, If I Can't Dance is an Amsterdam-based organization dedicated to exploring the evolution and topology of performance and performativity in contemporary art. This is done through the development, production, and presentation of commission projects with artists, curators, and researchers on a long-term basis of collaboration and support. The script reading Grant, Anique, and the cast present tonight weaves through interviews and the interviewing form in its exploration of voice and positionality and the archival textures of collective queer micropolitics. So I'll talk with you all again a bit later after Salim's Congress speech, and the floor is all yours.
My name is Michelle Dizon. I'm an artist, writer, filmmaker, teacher, and scholar. I'm very moved by the work of Hélène Cissou. I remember one passage in her book, Root Prints, where she writes how glad she is that this one feminist activist friend of hers exists, because that friend does everything that she can do to protect the political. And she says, that is what opens up space for her to protect the poetic. And more than anything, I'm moved by the work of Audre Lorde, who from a black feminist lesbian position says that poetry is not a luxury, is not only for the wealthy, but describes it as the very quality of light by which we scrutinize our lives. So in this context, I really think that we need to shift away from an idea of expression that's grounded in a kind of individualist notion of what it means for me to tell you about myself, and instead try to understand poetics as this work in the space in between our being together. Fundamental to that might also be an understanding of ourselves as subjects of history. And by that I mean that we are subjects constituted within social and political and historical circumstances, which have in fact determined what we can understand as our desire, or what we can understand as what is possible for ourselves in the world. And for me, that's not a kind of an impingement, let's say, on the idea of expression. It's actually a precondition for an idea of expression that exists in the space in between, in the relation that we hold to each other. I've also been taught by women of color that it's very necessary to think and work in the gaps in between discourses. And I think that comes out of an understanding that as subjects of history, we are operating within layered sides of oppression. And so when one works in the gap, or when one works in the silences, it actually offers a condition of possibility for thinking critically about the ways in which discourse is not just language as it exists and can be expressed, but the ways in which discourse actually has very real material effects on our lives.
Hello. I'm Anique Fournier, and I'm the curator of the archive and research at If I Can Dance, I Don't Want to Be Part of Your Revolution. And we just listened to the director of If I Can Dance, Frédéric Bercholtz, read a fragment from our archive, and specifically from How We Behave, an ongoing project by artist, curator, and writer Grant Watson, that If I Can Dance commissioned in 2014. And Grant's starting point for how we behave was an interview with Michel Foucault published in Vanity Fair in 1983. And the proposition in that interview was that ideas and technique of self-care and ethical conduct from the past could be useful in the present, and especially in relation to complex social realities and political projects of individuals and communities seeking emancipation. Grant was especially interested in what they offered to his personal relationship with and research into queer contemporary experience, gay liberation, and feminist movements. Together with Frederik Bercholtz and the then If I Can Dance curator Vivian Searle, Grant turned to the interview format, interviewing cultural practitioners, academics, and activists in six different cities, including writer and curator David de Bossa in 2013. And David should have been with us here this evening, but due to COVID, is not present. Daily activities like note-taking, diet, sex, reading, work, walking, production, experimentation, abstinence, death, spirituality, and friendship became the points of entry into the life world of these individuals. In a second phase of the process, Grant weaved out storylines from some of the interviews, editing the original transcripts into shorter versions, which led to the final materialization of the If I Can Dance Commission in 2014. And this was 13 video portraits in which the scripts were reperformed by the interviewees for a camera. And the work went on to be shown in several exhibition settings. And yet, the 13 video portraits share but a small selection of the many interviews and richness of what had become a large and textured archive of interview material and life stories. And you can see the full list of interviewees on the screen and on the handouts I believe you received coming in here. And Grant has continued to extend the project's cartography of interviewees to Brussels, Antwerp, Athens, New Delhi, Mumbai, and Utrecht, where he interviewed his cohorts in 2020 from the BAC Fellowship Program, including independent media producer and feminist media activist Diana McCarthy, here with us today. It is also at BAC that Grant began to experiment with having the scripts de-individuated and detached from a particular interviewee and read by another person, demonstrating the capacity of stories to echo across positionalities and the entanglement of the individual realm with the collective and the political. It is as a reader, a script reader, that the performance artist, choreographer, and queer academic Nando Messias, who is also sitting with us here today, first entered the project. At the same time, at If I Can Dance and in conversation with Grant, I was busy gathering the heap of archival material that had accumulated around how we behave, with the goal of getting the project up to date within our institutional archive. And like the If I Can Dance website, our archive is structured around live moments and events. This was the spring of 2020 amidst the first lockdown when many of us were pressed to rethink our habitual ways of living and rituals of self-care. And within this context, the content of the archive of life practices offered so many new perspectives and ways of being in the world and with others in the presence, leading to a deep desire to share. So together with Megan Hutker, who you all know already, but who is also has been mentioned, is a curator at If I Can Dance, we invited Grant to think of the ways the material from How We Behave could inhabit our studio space, an online platform that contrasts with our official event-based website, offering glimpses onto the process, ongoing research, and everyday work of If I Can Dance's institutional practice. Here, Megan and I were interested in how the many facets and types of material from the How We Behave archive could reconfigure the assumed pastness of documents and stress rather their liveness. Under the title How We Behave, an Archive of Radical Practice, and in close dialogue with Grant, we have this far uploaded on three occasions clusters of sound recordings, scripts, transcripts, photos, and Grant's ongoing reflections around the project, which we invite you to visit on our If I Can Dance Studio page. It is in the spirit of this recent activation of how we behave as research in performance that we want to share the archival material and life practices with you today in the form of script readings that weave together fragments from the archive's interviews. But maybe just before we begin, Grant, I think it's interesting how you have spoken of the interview format as a ritualized performance space. And how, I think it's interesting to hear more about how the interview is working in the project as a method, as a thematic, and what exactly its relation to performance is for you.
Thanks. The ritualized performance space actually comes from an anthropologist called Jonathan Skinner. And so when I started researching interviews, I looked a bit at the ethnographic interview. And what was quite interesting was that there he talks about it being a kind of ritual that we all understand. We understand the format of the interview on the whole. But also that it's, rather than it being a kind of fact-finding mission, it's more of a kind of meaning-making situation. And this is interesting also in terms of the performative and the context of If I Can't Dance as a kind of performance organization. In terms of the way that the interview fits into the process of making the project or building the archive, the interview is sort of one section of it. So that's the moment. Generally, it's a kind of one-to-one interview where, you know, I kind of collect the words and the materials. And then there's a second stage where the interviews are edited into these kinds of scripts, and I take my voice out of that. And what that means is that in situations like this, the interviews start to speak to each other and become more of a constellation. I think Megan said, it sort of de-individuates the interviews and they become these stories, or you said, sorry.
Indeed, and How We Behave really presents the archive as a site then of liveness. It's an archive of life experience, an archive of queer life. Maybe it's interesting to hear more about the demographics of the interviewees.
I think the demographic extends largely from my own network and our network, actually, and it's sort of, in geographic terms, you sketched out a little bit, you know, the places we went to. I think, you know, represented here interviews from India, Brazil, from the United States, so it's quite broad-based. And I suppose because it's my network, it's kind of situated within the sort of cultural sphere, cultural workers, people maybe with a connection to academia. It also has a kind of political dimension to it. When you sort of use the word queer, I think that using that word is not so much about a kind of identity position. It's more about, I think, the idea of bringing these queer and feminist narratives out of the archive. Putting them in kind of relationship to each other. I think you talked about this idea of a kind of shared micropolitics or a sort of texture of a shared micropolitics, which I think is the idea.
Noting, writing has always been a part of my life since I was a very little child. My relation to writing began at school when I was 5 or 6 years old, and my teacher phoned my mother to say that I should make something of my writing because there was a special thing going on there. And what I write is always a kind of research, and it is a very important part of my life, which I couldn't live without. It has to do with being affected by the environment and a different way of feeling and seeing than the one we're used to. And I feel convoked to find words to express that, because for me, words are not only form and content. but they are also form and forces. They are life. So I have always had this fundamental need to find words for those experiences of feeling and seeing in another way, as an effect of the forces of the world, as a living body. Since the beginning of my life, this is my problem. And you could ask why. It's a stupid question, but I can say a very obvious thing, that I was born just 3 years after the Holocaust. My father and my mother were Polish. They came to Brazil before the war. They lost 40 people to the Nazis in Poland. And I was the first one that was born after that, the first girl. And of course, I was in an environment totally traumatized by this terrible banalité du mal, a strong evil experience. And when you deal with trauma, generally, you deny it in order to survive and let the next generation, the third generation, finally deal with it. And I dealt with it since the beginning. And if you're not submitting to the trauma, and if you're not in denial of its effects, you have such an intimacy with life as really the important, the fundamental ethic of existence, and all the rest is secondary. And then for me, very young, I had the dictatorship experience, as many people of my generation did here. And I was in jail, but then jail was not so bad because I wasn't tortured. And when you live in a dictatorship, when you're in jail, you know the worst is there. The fact is, I was part of the counterculture, and my life was totally experimental, always. But during that period, it was very strong because there was a whole collective territory doing that, trying that. But at the same time, I had this intellectual eroticism and political conscience. But politics for me has a total link with the way I behave in my life, and it has a total link with psychoanalysis. What have these things to do with politics? For me, always, since very young, I was sure that behavior is politics. The way we relate to the world is politics. But politics in what sense? Because when we talk about politics, we Western and modern subjects, it is the French Revolution. Politics for us is the relation with the state, the relation between classes, races, etc., etc. It's a kind of struggle between opposite interests. It has to do with democracy, with civil rights, which is, of course, a very important layer of our life. But there is another dimension to politics, which is not at all that. That, for me, was always very important. It has to do with art. It has to do with poetics. And it has to do with clinical therapeutic practices.
So as we can hear, there's a specific relationship to politics of the material in the archive. Can you say something about how you came to this subtitle, An Archive of Radical Practice? What does radical mean in this?
I mean, I think that the text that Nando was reading from Sueli Rolnick, I think it kind of, you know, many of the interviewees address this question of what is politics? What is it to have a political practice? How does that relate to biography, to experience, to positionality? And so one of the things that kind of sort of emerged really as a question was that. And also, what does that mean in terms of scale and register? And I think one of the things about the selections of these texts that are being read this evening has to do with that the kind of different registers and scales of the political. I think that what unites them is a kind of, they're kind of anti-fascist texts. And so each of them, I mean, the one that Nando just read, you know, talks about historical fascism. Others talk about contemporary fascism or micro-fascism. And the different ways that one might kind of, you know, work towards contesting, fighting, challenging that.
In July of 2009, the Delhi High Court read down Section 377 of the Indian Penal Code, put in place by T.B. McCauley, who was an English jurist in the 19th century, which criminalized all sexual acts against the order of nature. It read down the judgment, saying that this won't apply anymore to consenting adults. Then, on the 11th of December, 2013, Gyara Bara Tera, 11-12-13, the Supreme Court of India inverted that judgment and said that Section 377 is constitutional and it will remain on the Indian Penal Code. And if someone has to change it, the legislature should change it. The parliament should change it. So on that day, we did a massive protest called Global Day of Global Day of Rage, GDR, where folks from London, New York, Los Angeles, Boston, Philadelphia, Hyderabad, Bombay, Calcutta, Delhi, Jaipur, Chandigarh, as well as in smaller and bigger ways and in other cities, spoke out against the judgment of the Supreme Court. And during that day, I was thinking, here's a progressive high court judgment being inverted by the Supreme Court, but will that legal inversion by the Supreme Court be able to stem the kind of social life that the LGBT activists have managed to give this court case and the kind of consequences in society that it has created? The conversations that the LGBT activists have made available to the world throughout the 90s and into the 2000s cannot be stymied simply by one judgment. And that's the point that I made when I read a poem out loud on stage during the GDR.
What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun, or fester like a sore and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat, or crust and sugar over like a syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load, or does it explode?
That's the poem. It's one of the most popular poems by Langston Hughes. It's called Harlem. I translated, and that's something you do as a literary exercise, and it's something you do for the poets that you love. But at that point, the frisson, the kind of effective energy, the kind of absolute softening of the bones that it created in my body and in the reaction of the audience, it spoke to me. The fact is that one small legal dream had been deferred, but an explosion had already taken place in terms of the social consensus on the question of same-sex desire and LGBT politics in India. So the legal dream might have been deferred, but all the other forms that this dream takes is something Langston Hughes opened up for me, and he was writing it for Harlem. He was writing it for what happens to a dream deferred in which we are not allowed to intermarry, in which we are not allowed to vote in several states. So that dream is not something that we can occupy. But here's Harlem. And here it is exploding with writers and with filmmakers and with artists of all kinds. Here it is bringing us a different consciousness of how we understand African-American people and Black people in the US. He's trying to match that vocabulary. One particular dream might have been deferred, but so many dreams have been enlivened. So in the 1950s Harlem, and in how Langston Hughes lived it, I saw some parallels with my life over here.
Rick and I both joined a radical fairy group around the same time as being part of the Bay Area Gay Liberation Movement, known as BAGL. BAGL was conceived as a pan-leftist organization which lasted for a year and a half before it split into factions. Because even then, there were the revolutionaries and there were the civil rights assimilationists. When the Bay Area Gay Liberation Movement divided in 1977, On the one side were the New Deal Democrats, the Democratic Socialists, the unaffiliated general leftists, the Trotskyites and the anarchists. On the other side, the people who got to keep the name Bagel because they had more votes at the divorce meeting included basically the Maoists. And then there was a division of the Sissy Fairy collection of people, which divided a group who were trying to deal with the spiritual aspect of gay liberation, with roots in Wicca and other European witchcraft traditions. And I had some of these witches on the Gay Life radio program, including Assunta Familia, the highly spiritual person who stayed in both groups. She's the one who read the curse against Dan White.
White. Dan White. It's been driving me mad to tell you this. For the murder of one Italian middle-class, allegedly heterosexual liberal mayor, and for the murder of one bourgeois Jewish faggot, I promise you this. If you plead insanity, I promise you this. If you get off because of insanity, I promise you this. You will go stark raving mad.
There is no question that state power can be overwhelming. It can be brutal. It can also be very emancipatory. So I think that's what the fight is about. That's what the resistance is about. We are not surrendering all the spaces, and there's no reason on earth why we should. For whatever it's worth, after 65, 70 years of a democratic foundation, those are the spaces and those are the structures that we will use to fight the battle. So it's not simply about a kind of a hippie battle on the beach. It's also about deepening institutions, institutional responsibility, accountability, transparency, and eventually, whether the constitution that you proudly tell the world you're about, fundamental rights, equality for all, non-discrimination, is that real or is that out there as a floozy when you're actually turning into a tin pot dictatorship? Because I think we really are on a threshold. I don't use the word fascism lightly because it's stupid. We don't have fascism in power, but we do have fascists who are in positions of power. So their mindset is fascist. They're not been able to completely convert because it's not so easy, but they are trying to transfer a lot of the public resources to corporate capital. And they're trying to use social political majoritarianism, which has a religious dimension. And eventually, they are hugely admiring of both Mussolini and Hitler. And it's a very dangerous moment for India. The whole world is moving in a right-wing direction, as you know. So we have to muddle our way out of that. And culture is critical, but the problem with creative individuals is that everybody is working on their own dream and their own tomorrow. Whereas here, we have to admit that this is a political project. So we're trying to say that you need to put in at least 3 hours a day. Even if you do 8 or 10 hours a day of your own stuff, you need 3 hours a day to do some dedicated, coordinated work, because otherwise it all becomes too free-flowing.
Because some of my own research is into militant women, I'm looking at violence. And I suppose I'm less interested in physical violence than what constitutes violence versus how do you take up arms. And for me, at this point in my life, I would arm myself with media, counter-narratives, the important weapons of our time. It's interesting because I do come from such an incredibly violent place. And by that, I mean not just the US, but New Mexico in particular. This probably has something to do with low literacy rates, low levels of education, and high levels of poverty. So people often solve conflicts with violence. Growing up, I was very, very big, especially in a Mexican community where people tend to be smaller. So I was much bigger than average. I was also kickboxing, so I happened to be quite a badass. I got into a few little fights, not that many, several in my early teens. I had to fight a few times, just enough to not have to fight a lot more. I grew up in a racially conflicted zone. So for example, we would go roller skating on Saturday nights. And at that time, Albuquerque had 3 roller skating rinks. One was very much white culture, one was rather black culture, and one was like Chicano culture, where you would have a mixture of mostly brown people and a few gangs. I would have been around 12 or 13. I could date it because it was around when I was reading the Communist Manifesto and when the prison riot in Santa Fe, New Mexico happened. That was the most violent prison riot in the history of the US. So we were at this skating rink and this white girl made a racist comment about my neighbor Charlie. And he was like a little brother to me, my partner in crime for most of my childhood and teenage years. I, of course, took offense. It was also this very macho culture where it was not appropriate and it would not have been acceptable for this young man to shout at this girl. So then I offered that she should leave or I would rip her head off. She responded by calling her friend, Godzilla the Hun, who came and who must have been 18, I mean, a bit older than I was. It would have been illegal for her to fight with me. These were rock and roll people, long hair, heavy metal, 4 of them in a Jeep. 4 white women showed up, super white, big, including this woman who I was meant to fight. It was kind of like a race riot. Outside the roller skating rink, my mom is waiting in her car to take Charlie and me home. She didn't catch any of this, not even when at some point the police came. So I'm standing looking straight ahead at this woman's muscle boobs. I can't look up at her face because that would be an admission of weakness. I was like, okay, I am going to get my ass kicked. There were far more brown people present than white people, and there was this very violent circle around me and Godzilla. Anyhow, there I am staring down muscle boobs, this woman, this teenage girl, but, you know, quite a bit older than I was, all muscle. And I was thinking, okay, kickboxing won't help. I might get in one punch, but she's gonna murder me. And then I was like, okay, this is fine. I have my strategy. I will grab her face and scratch the hell out of it. So she might kick my ass, but she will never forget this night. She'll have scars forever. And that was what I was prepared to do. I did not stand down. I believe there were some exchanges which I weirdly don't remember. The important thing was that I did not back down one inch. Even then, I was outraged at the stupidity of this young girl doing a racist thing. I was like, what's wrong with you? Go to the white place. If you need to roller skate and be racist, there's a safe space for you. Then the police came and broke it up, so in the end, I didn't have to fight. But I wasn't scared. That was the thing. I had accepted my fate, which was getting my ass whopped badly. I was a decent kickboxer, but this wouldn't have helped. I mean, she really was. It was just one big muscle. Yeah. I mean, they were like out of an 80s movie. The whole thing was like an 80s movie. Anyhow, it just got diffused by the police showing up. But I was the last one to leave the circle. I had stood my ground. And the thing that was helpful here is that I was right. I was not backing down from being in the right about this racist incident. So one of the things that came out of this is that I was never a pacifist. I'll fight if I have to, lose even. And it is also when I started to become politicized, when I started to say, okay, there are forces that operate against all of us. And this internal violence is another way of keeping us down. And that violent reactions are not necessarily wrong. But if one is going to act violently, what are the tools you use and what are the enemies you have? That's something I gained from that time, getting politically conscious and understanding how this relates to my life. But then also figuring out how to be in the world in a way that matters, and in a way where you understand your politics not only as an abstract thing, but how it relates to how I live, how I go about my daily life, what I eat, what I drink, who I eat and drink with, how I get from point A to point B. What are the conditions that allow me to move freely or not? What are the conditions that allow others to move freely or not? So how all of these are part of politics, and how this basic existence connects to other things that can seem quite abstract. So Charlie died on January 5th, 2022. It was from a brain aneurysm he'd suffered a few weeks before in a bar fight.